The MDT Podcast.
I am Ian Wilkinson.
And I'm Philippa Christie. I'm one of the registrars at East Surrey Hospital.
In this episode, we're going to just briefly talk around some of the posters that were there at the conference. A mixture of sort of small research studies and quality improvement work that sit within the clinical quality section at the BGS and also the scientific research section. But first, we're going to indulge and we're going to talk about one of some work that we've done. And Philippa, you had a poster.
Yes, so I had a poster about the MDT podcast. This looked at how it improves people's knowledge after listening to the podcast. And we focused on the episodes directed on falls. So there's three episodes on falls, which you should be able to find on the website. And we looked at the outcomes from the CPD log, which is collected if you go onto the website and listen to the podcast, then you can fill in a voluntary CPD log and it asks you to rate your knowledge. Then it asks two questions. So what did you learn and how will this affect your practice? And we looked at the quantitative results, which showed that listening to the podcast does improve self-perceived knowledge on the topic of falls. We also did a thematic analysis on the qualitative answers to the questions which were asked in the CPD log. And this gave us four different themes which people have taken away from listening to the podcast. So the first one was the need for MDT working in falls management. The second was new interventions to or with patients. So this was either educational, psychological or physical interventions. And also the importance of comprehensive geriatric assessment. And then the last theme was a deeper thinking about the causation of falls. So the poster showed some different quotes taken from the CPD log, obviously all anonymised, which showed what people had taken away in terms of each of those themes and how it will hopefully have affected their practice in the future. This poster showed that the data we'd collected had shown that the podcast does improve people's knowledge of falls, which is very reassuring.
That's fab, yeah, thank you. And thank you for analysing that as well. Yeah. So the first poster we're going to talk about is one of ours, actually. Philippa's, it's yours, isn't it?
My poster was entitled Educating on Falls, the Role of Podcasts, and was about how the MDT podcast can be used to improve people's knowledge on particular topics. So we picked topic of falls, and there are three episodes on falls at the moment. There's falls acute management, there's preventing falls, and there's fear of falling. We looked at the number of downloads for each of these podcasts. So the acute management had the most at 3,239, preventing falls was 1,868, and fear of falling was 1,438 downloads. And we looked at how these podcasts had actually changed people's knowledge about the topic of falls. And we did this through analysis of the CPD log, which is voluntary and available on the website after you've listened to the episodes. So we analysed 69 of those feedback forms, and we looked at the quantitative data, which was based on a Likert scale, asking you to rate your self-perceived knowledge pre and post listening to the podcast, which shows that there was a significant improvement in knowledge post listening to the podcast. And we did a thematic analysis of the qualitative answers to the feedback questions, which were what did you learn and how will this change your practice? And this revealed four main themes, which were the need for MDT working in falls management, new interventions to or with patients, which was either educational, psychological or physical interventions, the importance of comprehensive geriatric assessment, and also a deeper thinking about the causation of a fall. And we've got various quotes on the poster which were taken from the analysis and anonymised. And the conclusion was that the podcasts had significantly improved listeners' knowledge about falls, and so we can hope that it improves people's knowledge about everything else as well.
Cool, yeah, that's fab. So the second poster we're going to talk about was Alex Bushells. Alex is a physiotherapist at Ashford and St Peter's Hospital in Chertsey in Surrey. And she looked at an exercise intervention program for after people had fallen and broken their hip. And they called it the Staying Steady Exercise and Education Program, or STEEP. And it was a pilot program to try and assist in the prevention of further falls. So they looked at 26 patients that had attended their STEEP program, and most of them, 22 of the 26, had completed the full exercise program. They looked at their timed up and go, and showed, and also the change in the Berg balance scale and the falls efficacy scale, and also the number of admissions pre and post for falls after the exercise program. And essentially what they showed is that the number of admissions reduced and the number of falls reduced, and the timed up and go got a bit better, all significantly, although on small numbers. And their conclusion was that the pilot of STEEP showed that there was improvements in timed up and go, falls efficacy scale and the Berg balance scale, and therefore potentially this exercise program was an effective exercise and education program for the prevention of falls. And I think one of the things that was really nice about this poster is the recognition that actually, as well as strength and balance training, there is an educational component as to why people are falling over and what we can do to try and reduce that, and involving patients in education around that is an important bit. So then, wandering along a bit further, shall we go with this one from Salford, Philippa?
Yeah, so this was a poster entitled Management of Constipation in Parkinson's Disease, and it looked at what we're doing to tackle constipation, which is a very common problem in patients who have Parkinson's disease. So it was a systematic review of 27 studies, including sort of 10 randomised control trials, and then some articles, including case control studies, and then a cohort study and cross-sectional studies. And the basic conclusions from this was that there's insufficient evidence to recommend any particular treatment option for the management of constipation in Parkinson's disease, which is important for us to know, particularly as it's looking at so many different studies. So it's quite a good way of looking at all the evidence together.
Yeah, I think, and constipation is such a common non-motor symptom in Parkinson's disease. I think just being aware that maybe there is that lack of evidence is important. And it made me think of an article that Henry Woodford wrote in the BGS news letter back, I think it was October time, looking at some of the evidence behind sodium docusate, and actually how there isn't evidence really for the use of sodium docusate as an evidence-based treatment for constipation in older people. And actually there's also a couple of articles out there suggesting this is a good opportunity for deprescribing, because it really isn't a non-evidence-based treatment. But unfortunately, what neither of those things do is tell us what is the evidence. And so I guess there's a question there for going to look at, another proper, well-controlled, designed trial to look at what is the better treatments options for constipation in people with Parkinson's. Intuitively, you'd think that it's something that is a stimulant laxative.
Yeah, you'd think so, and that may be what people tailor their treatment to at the moment. But I think in practice it might have an impact on how well tolerated in terms of side effects that particular laxatives are. So we don't have to go down the alley of using one particular laxative, because it's really good if it's not well tolerated by the patient. So that leads us more onto the person-centred care. Yeah. And we can use something that is well tolerated and the patient feels is useful for them. So I suppose that's the silver lining of that cloud, I suppose.
You couldn't have done that better, because that's a lovely segue, because what I wanted to talk about was the next poster, which is looking at adverse drug reactions in people with Parkinson's and what is tolerated and what is not. And this is a paper from the Movement Disorder Clinic in the Rockwood Hospital in Cardiff, who actually gave a couple of talks between them on the Parkinson's session. And it sounds like they've got a really nice clinic. And they've got a couple of posters, one of which was looking at the use of a PKG But the one I wanted to focus on was this one, which is called Type A Adverse Drug Reactions and Weight Loss Are Correlated in Idiopathic Parkinson's Disease. And essentially what they did was, it was a retrospective cohort study of patients in their movement disorder clinic. They looked at disease severity of Parkinson's by using the Hearn and Yar staging system. They looked at weight loss that they divided up into a number of different categories, from no weight loss through to more than 10% body weight loss. And they looked at side effects from drug treatments. What they haven't written in their methods is where they got these side effects from. Sort of how accurate is the assessment of side effects? You know, does it come from the letters or do they have some kind of formal log of this? But what they found was that patients with idiopathic Parkinson's disease who have any degree of weight loss are significantly more likely to experience medication side effects. Type 1 side effects are predictable dose-dependent side effects, so things like nausea or dyskinesia with levodopa. And it was quite a stark poster, really, in that there was significance across all levels. There's a trend to more significant side effects, and in fact, every patient had some side effects if they had lost lots of weight. So there's a trend towards more side effects for more weight loss, but I think it's just a reminder of kind of the distribution of some of these drugs, and the pharmacokinetics of drugs in older people can change, particularly as people lose weight.
I think as so much of the conference is focused on frailty and sarcopenia, actually recognising weight loss in Parkinson's as a risk factor for having higher side effects with medications also has other implications in terms of recognising frailty and whether or not that's having more of an impact on their life, or actually meaning that they can't manage the side effects that perhaps they would have been able to manage had they been more sort of physically robust and strong, as it were. That's just something that I thought about looking at that poster, so I think it's interesting to know that for how we tailor our treatment to our patients.
So wandering down the posters a little bit more, shall we have a look at this one, which was from Inderpal Singh and Anthony Johansson's group in Wales, looking at inpatient hip fractures?
Yeah, and the main point from this was in the 118 patients that they reviewed who had an inpatient hip fracture, the mortality was 4 times higher than those who had inpatient fractures as opposed to having an outpatient fracture. So that's really, really important for us to know when we're thinking about falls prevention in hospital. So wandering down the corridor a little bit more, there's this poster, which is on fear of falling, from Palo Alto Medical Center in America.
This one looked at the falls rates and fear of falling between, and looking for a difference between men and women with age-related macular degeneration, and essentially showed that there was a similarity in falls rates and fear of falling in both of these groups of people with visual loss. And it was that the fear of falling was slightly higher in females more than males, but not significantly so. But with both groups, fear of falling was significant. And that is even patients who hadn't had a fall, I believe. And I think it's just to remember, really, even if people don't have visual loss, that fear of falling is a really significant factor. And we need some good, robust evidence for treatments to reduce fear of falling. And then, so the final one is a poster from Montreal in Canada. And this was looking, it's called How Robust Are Frailty Assessments? And it was a systematic review of the application of frailty in the surgical population. And they looked at 2.5 million surgical patients with a mean age of just over 60. And 20% of these patients had surgery for cancer. And 50% of them were for elective surgery. And frailty was prevalent in around a third of the patients and was most prevalent in those people with lung transplantation and least prevalent in patients undergoing gynecological surgery. Which I don't think is that unexpected.
No, I wouldn't have thought so at all. And the take-home points from this poster was that frailty is really prevalent in patients undergoing elective surgical procedures and is associated with adverse outcomes. And techniques used to recognise frailty, of all the techniques they trialled in this study, the Rockwood model had the most stable estimates of prevalence, which is very useful for us to use and it's quite easy to use in practice, I think.
And I think when they talk about the Rockwood model, I think they're talking about the clinical frailty scale, which is the Canadian one with the pictures, rather than the frailty index or some of other of Rockwood's work. And yeah, so I think that's a sort of a snapshot of the posters. If you're interested in all of that, please subscribe to the podcast, or you can visit the website, which is www.thehearingaidpodcast.org.uk, or you can follow us on Twitter at @MDT_podcast or facebook.com/MDT podcast. And if you're interested in helping us appraise some of the outcomes from the podcast, we'll be conducting some focus groups at the BGS meeting in Leicester in November. So do get in touch with us, pop along, come and have a chat about the podcast.
The MDT Podcast.